A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave and Dejanovic, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Ooh, the Supreme Court of the United States, it's a big, big case that they're taking on, and it has to do with the First Amendment, and we're going to dive headfirst into that today.
Not all of the cases that the Supreme Court listens to are home runs. Like, big talkers. I think you just read the headline.
Yeah, so the SCOTUS blog on Twitter says, next, if First Amendment blockbusters aren't your speed, how about a technical spat over appellate jurisdiction to review certain types of bankruptcy orders? Yeah, we'll stick with the First Amendment case. That's huge.
We could actually sink our teeth into that one and understand it a little bit, but my goodness, the things they listen to. It's 9:06. It's time for the launch.
Sequence engaged.
And here are three things that Debbie wants you to know.
Countdown. Three.
I don't want to take anything away from Senator Mitt Romney, who helped secure millions of dollars a year to study our shrinking Great Salt Lake. At 10:05 this morning, University of Utah professor Kevin Perry, who's been sounding the alarm for years about the drying Great Salt Lake, is going to join us live because I want to ask him, do we have years and years to study the shrinking Great Salt Lake? Because, I mean, it seemed pretty dire right now.
Yeah, I mean, 5 years from now, Debbie, it might be filled up again.
Mm.
Or it might be bone dry. Tens of millions of dollars to study this. That might sound like a lot of money, but it might cost billions to fix it or billions to deal with the consequences. I think of California's Lake Owens. That dried up, right? Fault of humanity. They've spent over $2 billion, Debbie. $2 billion trying to deal with the toxic dust that blows up. And Lake Owens, 1,200 acres. Great Salt Lake, 1 million acres.
Countdown to...
In 30 minutes, we're going to dive into this discussion about lawmakers facing the $50 million question. Will they fund optional full-day kindergarten across Utah? Not just in certain communities, but all across Utah. Yeah, full day. Your five-year-old goal goes to school full day. Utah's well below the rest of the United States. About a third of five-year-olds attend full-day kindergarten. Across the country, it's more than 80%. But you can't attend here if it's not offered, so maybe that's why we're at 34%.
I have no doubt that full-day kindergarten is very good for parents. I'm not so sure it's very good for kids. And the reason I say that is because I talked to three kindergarten teachers. None of them like the idea of full-day kindergarten.
Launch countdown one.
Our top story this morning is that question being argued before the Supreme Court of the United States. Can a Colorado website designer refused to design a wedding website for same-sex couples?
Yeah, this is going to be a huge conversation we have today on the show. I'm very sensitive because I see both sides. Very sensitive to discrimination. We have an ugly, awful history of discrimination in this country. Not just sexual orientation, but race and religion. That being said, should somebody be compelled to write something or say something or create something that they don't want to? For whatever reason, should speech ever be compelled?
Dave and Dejanovic.
The launch.
Commence.
KSL's top national story. Special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
She's a web designer with Christian beliefs. She says won't allow her to design a website for same-sex couples. They were to get married. Although same-sex marriages and weddings might be against her faith, SCOTUS said this case is about free speech rights.
Yes, and there's a big difference between this case and the Colorado Baker case from a few years ago. You'll remember the Colorado Baker didn't want to make same-sex wedding cakes. He said it's against his religious beliefs. The court essentially punted on this one and kind of pushed it down the road. But this, again, is not about religious freedom and religious expression. It is all about free speech.
So free speech on a wedding cake, to me, is a lot different than free speech on a website. And this case is specifically about a web designer in Colorado who doesn't ultimately want to design wedding websites for gay couples. And wedding websites are a big thing right now. You know, it's all the rage. If you're getting married, you probably have a website so people can go on and RSVP or, you know, maybe pick a gift from that website for you. So she wants to create a company. And she's told the media, look, I have worked with gay couples in the past. I just don't want to my faith doesn't we don't believe in same-sex marriages. So I don't want my web design company to become about designing websites for same-sex couples for their wedding. So it's specifically about that.
Yes. And this is a preemptive strike, which is very interesting. It's an interesting angle to this because typically something has to have had to happen
like
first.
Like a lawsuit.
Yeah. And someone's like, you can't do that to me. This is, again, a preemptive strike. She's trying to figure out, am I going to be in trouble if I say no to same-sex couples if they want me to build them a website?
So what caused her to challenge this? Well, according to the Associated Press and other media organizations that are following this, it's a Colorado law. It's a public accommodations law, which if you open your doors as a company, like, you know, a retail outlet, a website designer in the state of Colorado, you can't just pick and choose who you serve. If she offers wedding websites to the general public, to everyone across the board, she must provide them to all customers or be fined. That's the interpretation of the Colorado law. And let me point out, Utah has a similar law. So you think, oh, this is a Colorado case. This just affects the a website designer in Colorado. It could impact businesses here in Utah, too.
Exactly. When the Supreme Court makes a ruling, now everybody plays by those rules, those exact same rules. So just because they're ruling on something in Colorado, it will absolutely affect us here in Utah.
Now, you spent a lot of years as a freelance photographer and videographer. And you also videotaped weddings specifically. So let's talk about that. What's your feeling on this?
Yeah, it's very interesting because, again, you've done a lot of freelance work. I've done a lot of freelance work. At what point can you say yes to something and no to another?
So give me an example.
Could I film a wedding? So I did a lot of like wedding stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And would I be able to say yes to a regular marriage, I guess, for lack of a better term? And could I say no to a same-sex couple? And the law says, no, I cannot. Now let's go a little bit more extreme.
Okay.
What if I, again, am hired to be a videographer? And someone wants me to shoot a pornographic video. I know that sounds extreme. Could I say no to that?
Oh.
Or am I compelled?
Because
I'm offering video services.
Right. That would not be part of your company brochure. That would not be part of your company offerings, right?
And I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. I would say no to that. Am I going to be compelled? Can I ever say no to a job? And that's the question I think that
as a private business owner.
As a private business owner, am I going to be compelled to say, well, you can't discriminate against this art, so to speak?
Well, let's continue that discussion and ask our KSL legal analyst, Greg Skordis, that question in 3 minutes.
Dave
and Dujanovic.
Start your mornings productively with important updates on breaking news,
traffic, and reliable weather.
You'll get it all on KSL from 5 to 9 with Tim and Amanda.
Utah's morning companions for news.
It's a magical time of year.
There are over 300 events downtown leading up to the holidays.
And there's something for everyone.
Downtown at Christmas is so much fun.
Hear about the latest events that make the Christmas season bright. Tim and Amanda, weekday mornings from 5 till 9. All this month on KSL News Radio. Dave and Dujanovic. KSL's top national story. Special coverage with Dave and Dujanovic.
There's a question being argued today before the Supreme Court of the United States. Should a web designer, a website designer, she's in Colorado, be forced to follow the state law in Colorado that requires she offer public accommodations to gay couples who want to design a website through her company?
And part of what makes this so interesting, Deb, is this is a preemptive strike. Which means there's not actually a same-sex couple that is suing this person. She wants to start a business, and she wants to know, will I be forced or will I have to create these websites with people that maybe don't share my beliefs?
Let's bring in KSL legal analyst Greg Skordas into the conversation. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, you guys.
So let's begin here. There's this law in Colorado that requires companies to open their doors for business to accommodate the public, whether it's a gay couple, whether it's an interracial couple, no matter what their race or their background is. So does Utah have a law similar to this? That's the first question I want to ask.
Yes, we do. It's a little bit similar. Colorado is called their public accommodation law, as you just said, which basically says this: if you offer services to the public, if you open your doors to the public, that the public includes everyone. It includes all people. So you can't just open your doors to some members of the public and not to others. And Utah's law tracks that pretty closely, and that is that if you're a retail or in this case an online marketing or other company, and you want to open your doors, you want to make sure that you're available to the public, that you can't discriminate, you can't pick and choose who that public consists of.
The argument, and I saw this, or I was listening to SCOTUS blog, I'm sure you listened to that as well, but the argument is they're trying to regulate this individual's expression, violating essentially her First Amendment rights, her right to speak how she wants. The state says that they're regulating sales. So I kind of see both sides of this, Greg. Is it regulating expression or are they just regulating sales?
Well, kind of both, and that's a good argument. And what the liberals are saying here, the side on behalf of the LGBT community that thinks that they're being discriminated against, is that you can open your doors to the public and you can speak, you can use your First Amendment right to say, I don't approve of same-sex marriage, I don't approve of whatever else you have religious or other beliefs about, but you still have to provide the service. So they're saying your First Amendment or your religious freedom is not being restricted because you can still say and do those things, but once you open your doors, you have to provide the same service to everyone.
Is this about the First Amendment and free speech, or is this about religious freedom? Because she said this is against, it would be against her religious values, her Christian values, to create a website for a gay couple who was, you know, seeking a wedding website, for example, to get married. So what is this case really about?
Well, it's about all of that and what we call equal protection. So the Supreme Court's got to jump into all of this. And if you recall, Debbie, there was the Colorado cake maker that had the same very, very similar issue come up several years ago, and the Supreme Court sort of kicked it back to Colorado and said, let's decide this under Colorado law, and ultimately the cake baker sort of half won and half lost, but was fined a little bit at the end. This case is now is really going on federal constitutional grounds and not so much the state of Colorado's, and I don't know the answer to your question. I've sort of danced around a little bit here because that's what the Supreme Court's going to decide, whether or not her religious freedom rights trump the other side's equal protection argument.
I've done a lot of freelance work in my life, and the question I have ultimately is this. Can I ever refuse to do work? I'm going to use a more extreme example, but stay with me for a minute. If someone hired me to be a videographer, could I be forced by law to film a pornographic video, you know, something that is against my religious beliefs, but could I say no to that pornographic video? And if I could say yes or say no to the pornographic video, could I not say no? That sounds awkward. Let me try that again, Greg.
No. I think I know what you're saying.
Could I say no to the pornographic video, but not to a pornographic video involving LGBT individuals?
Yeah, that's a better question. And the answer to that would probably be no. You could certainly say no to a pornographic video that involved children, because that's against the law. There's a very bright line, clear line that's illegal. But as we know from the internet and what's gone on, that pornography is sort of way wide open out there. And so that's a good question. And I don't know the answer to it, Dave, whether you could refuse to do that for any reason other you know, just your own basic uncomfort with pornography. And so I haven't answered your question yet, but I think that would be sort of the next step that we would go to in cases like this. And maybe the Supreme Court will decide that very issue someday.
When can I refuse work?
Well, when it's illegal, or, you know, a lot of businesses, if you walk in the door, Dave, have these signs that say, "We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone," or "No shoes, no shirt, no service." So there are certain times when you can refuse things, as long as it's based on some constitutionally protected reasons, such as public health or something like that. You can say you have to wear a mask, but you can't say we're refusing service to African Americans, or we're refusing service to gay couples, or that type of thing, because those are constitutionally protected classes of people.
Well, when I see a sign, Greg, that says no shoes, no shirt, no service, I would assume that would mean everybody who walks through the door, not just people of a certain color, people of a certain sexual orientation. That is for everybody who walks through the door.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly the point. So everybody includes people who are part of a constitutionally protected class, and people who aren't wearing shoes are not constitutionally protected. So that's where the line is fairly clear. But you couldn't put a sign up in your door that said, "We refused to serve the Asian community," or something like that.
That was KSL legal analyst Greg Skordas.
Right. And he was helping us dive into the discussion about the case before the United States Supreme Court, which is being argued today. It has to do with a website designer in Colorado who says, "Look, it's a preemptive strike, hasn't really opened her business yet, but I don't want to be forced, because of my Christian values, to design a wedding website for a gay couple, because my religion does not agree with same-sex marriage." That's what we're talking about with Greg. We recorded that interview just a few minutes before 9 because he has a jury trial today.
Well, our minds want to go to people refusing work because of religious convictions. That is not what this case is about, though. It really is about free speech. And that is what the Supreme Court will be listening to. They are not going to be allowing this conversation of whether or not the baker or the website designer believes in same-sex marriage or not. That is not the argument. It will be very focused on free speech.
We used other examples in our kind of pre-show discussion about this, Dave, and one is, which was brought up by the Associated Press, and they were quoting somebody from the Jewish community and saying, would we be forced to then like create a website or propaganda or whatever the case may be for somebody who comes to us and says, "I'm a neo-Nazi and I demand that because you have your doors open or a company, I demand you make this brochure or create this website. It's all about neo-Nazism."
Yeah.
And your religious beliefs, totally. I mean, everything about every fiber in your body is against that. But that's not where the Supreme Court is going with this. They're going with the free speech, the First Amendment arguments.
Will you be compelled to write or say or present or create something that you don't want to? And that's ultimately what the argument is do you have the freedom to not say something? Or will you be compelled to say something that you don't believe?
We should know by June.
Yeah, let's not rush into them, folks. Let's not rush into
it. It is a SCOTUS case. We should know by June. Straight ahead, we're going to talk about full-day kindergarten maybe coming to your neighborhood school. Why we're saying that next.
Dave and Dejanovic, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM at 1160 AM. Utah's top local story, special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
Scrolling Twitter this weekend, and I spotted a tweet from the policy analyst for Voices for Utah Children. And it said that the Utah State Board of Education had voted near unanimously to support asking Utah lawmakers, Dave, for $51 million in change during the next session, which is, you know, starts in January, to fully fund optional full-day kindergarten statewide for families who want it.
Yeah, full-day kindergarten is a hot topic because I know a lot of parents that it's the bane of their existence to have to try to do this half-day kindergarten, drop the kids off, pick them up, then what do you do with them? When I look at full-day kindergarten, I think, why are we so anxious to just get kids in school for 7 hours a day? Like, at what point are we going to let kids be kids? The push for full-day kindergarten, for pre-K classes, it bugs me. I have no doubt that it's what's best for the parents. Many parents, it's very, very good to have that kind of built-in babysitter. But is it what's best for kids?
Built-in babysitter. Every teacher is listening. Is
punching me in the face right now.
What's the difference between kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade if you're talking full-day, all-day babysitters? Like, what's the difference?
You're 5 years old.
Oh, yeah, you are. You're 5 years old. And Utah's way behind the curve in this. Like, we aren't even on the curve. Nationally, according to the Utah full-day K site website, full-day kindergarten website, nationally, 82% of kids are enrolled in full-day kindergarten. Utah, it's a third of kids. So the Dave Noriegas of the world, you're winning. You're winning because we are way, way behind the national average on that.
It was interesting. Part of the reason I have the feelings or the thoughts that I do is I talked to three kindergarten teachers. Now, this is anecdotal, right? None of them like the idea of full-day kindergarten for this reason. He said, these kids are so done by half day. You know, this is their first introduction into school, most of them, or many of them, and they're just burnt out by the end of the day. So what are you gaining? How much are you gaining by keeping them there another 2 or 3 hours?
Anna Thomas is the policy analyst for Voices for Utah Children, and I spotted your tweet. It's good to have you on the line live this morning.
You must be one of my 12 devoted followers. Thank you, Debbie.
Well, I thought it was important to have this conversation because so many parents are and children are impacted by this. Do lawmakers, do you think they have an appetite this in 2023 to expand full-day kindergarten statewide, Anna?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they had the appetite last year, this last session. The bill that we had pushed to slowly expand statewide got a lot of support, and then just, you know, a week from the end of the session, things got a little upended and switched around. But I was really inspired by the appetite that they showed and continue to show for you know, expanding this to the parents who want it. To Dave's point, not everybody wants their kid in full day kindergarten. Not everybody feels like their kid is ready. And that's great, you know, and where we've seen different school districts and charter schools across the state expand their optional full-day kindergarten programs, they've accommodated parents that still want to be in half-day. They've accommodated parents who don't want their kids in any kindergarten. But the vast majority of parents prefer it. It is sort of the gold standard across the country. And, I mean, we can get into kids' ability to last for the whole day. We definitely hear much different reporting from teachers who teach full-day kindergarten who say, these little kids are ready for it. They can do it. You know, it's definitely age-appropriate. They get some play. They get some practice. They take more time with their transitions, all of that stuff. And I think, you know, as our state policymakers are understanding better that nobody has to do anything that's not right for their family, that this is pretty much a slam dunk.
We're joined right now by Anna Thomas, who's a policy analyst, Voices for Utah Children. Anna, one of the problems that I see here when you have, you know, some kids going to full-day kindergarten, some going to half-day kindergarten, is you are creating this group that obviously the full-day K kids are going to be more advanced going into first grade than the half-day kids. So does it create this gap, this learning gap for the first grade teachers?
So, Dave, are you saying full-day kindergarten is more effective at preparing children for school than half-day?
I think either all half-day or all full-day is going to probably help with the learning gap.
Yeah, no, I think you make a fair point, and I think that's partly why when optional full-day kindergarten is made available, so many parents opt to use it, not just because it's more convenient, which, as you've pointed out, it really is, but because they know their kids either need it or are ready for it or could really benefit from it. I think we do see a fair number of kids who opt for half-day kindergarten who have a lot of great learning support at home and in the rest of their lives. So those kids, they may start a little behind in terms of how to, you know, how to be with their peers, how to eat lunch with a lot of other little kids, how to, you know, transition from one activity to another throughout the day. They'll catch up in first grade, but they also maybe have gotten more individual parental attention, more home-based learning than kids who wouldn't have had those opportunities if they were in full day, if they were in half day and full day was what their family wanted for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fascinating conversation. Anna Thomas, thank you for joining us, who's a policy analyst for Voices for Utah Children.
So Dave, the dilemma that you brought up is this, is it best for kids or is this best for parents?
I know. It's such a hot topic. I have no doubt that it is best for parents. It is so much easier. I've been there. I'm not that far removed from trying to do that half-day kindergarten thing.
What do you mean? So basically what you're saying is this is better for parents than for the kids.
Yeah.
The full day. So it sounds like you're all in on then half-day daycare for kindergartners because that's what's happening for parents and
Some parents are working.
Many parents.
Yeah.
Especially with inflation the way it is. So many parents have had to go back to work or at least juggle maybe a second job. So you know, essentially what you're doing is you're shipping kids from the kindergarten class over to daycare.
In some cases, yeah. In some cases, that is not the case. Where parents are able to stay home, one parent has staggered their schedule, whatever it might be. My biggest concern, though, again, and this is always my concern, I want to make sure that whatever decision we make, whether it's half-day kindergarten or full-day kindergarten, that we're figuring out what is the best for kids, not what is most convenient for parents.
But if it's optional, which it would be opt-in, then each parent or parents could decide what's best for their five-year-old child.
And I find it so strange that we are so concerned about learning gaps, but this is one we just don't care about. Like, there's obviously going to be a learning gap between the half-day kindergarten kids and the full-day kindergarten kids. And those poor first-grade teachers have to catch all the half-day kids up.
Well, if you have one parent who stays home and to pick up the child in the afternoon and work with them, then conceivably they could help them stay caught up with their peers, even though they're not in full-day kindergarten, right?
So you're relying on the parents to make up the difference?
Well, parents got to, right? They're home with them.
Well, what about the parents that are every bit as involved in the full day? You are going to have a learning gap no matter what. and it is going to fall on the teachers to make that difference.
Parents versus kids. Who do you think all-day kindergarten serves? Is it the parents or is it the kids? 801-575-TALK, 801-575-TALK. Taking your live calls next.
Dave and Janik.
Talking about all-day kindergarten and the $51 million that the Utah State Board of Education is going to ask lawmakers for to fund it. Optional. It's optional if it is funded statewide. And Dave brought up this question. He wants calls as well. 801-575-TALK. Parents versus kids. Who does all-day kindergarten serve?
Yeah, and I definitely think it serves the parent more than the kid.
Mm.
Remember, kindergartners are 5 years old.
They're such just little babies.
They are such little babies. A lot of them, they can, I don't know, they're barely functioning human beings. I love five-year-olds, but they are so little. And when you go into these kindergarten classes, my wife works with kindergartners, and they are so tiny.
Uh-huh.
Now, the question is, should they be at school for 7 hours a day?
Remember, this is optional.
Yeah.
You know, if you decide that your child isn't quite ready for all-day kindergarten, you can opt out.
Yeah.
But, you know, 95%+ of families in Washington County, where St. George's, can't be wrong, right? Because when they started full-day kindergarten down there, 95%+ of them opted in to full-day kindergarten. I personally think all-day kindergarten serves the whole family.
It definitely serves the parents.
I think it's good for the child, too, because especially if you have working parents, there's consistency there. They're going to get shuttled to daycare. So they're going to get picked up by a bus, and then they got to get routed over to the daycare, and then they got to get settled into the daycare. This provides consistency for them. I would much rather my child be in a all-day kindergarten class with a certified teacher who, you know, carries the credentials and the education, then shuttled over to daycare. And right now, daycare is so costly that would certainly also save families a lot of financial anxiety. CNBC puts the average cost of year-round daycare at $8,300. That might be a little bit low. Let's get to your phone call. So what do you think? Is this better for the parents or better for the kids? Abby, good morning.
Hello.
Hi. What do you think?
Hi.
What do you think of full day kindergarten? Is it better for the parents or does it serve the kids?
Well, I'm a kindergarten teacher. And so what we have noticed, first, kindergarten is not required by the state. So some parents decide to start the child in first grade. Second, I do have day kindergarten. The thing that also what they're asking these children to do at this age is way more than they should be doing. They should be involved in more play. And right now we're teaching things that I don't believe are appropriate. We have to teach them to read and to write by the time they get out of kindergarten. And a lot of kids are not ready for this. So I believe that it's also for the parents. Parents want to have the children all day at school, just simply because they need
Abby, the time. So, I'm sorry. I just have to push back on this. Teaching kids how to read and write by the end of, by the time they're almost 6 years old, what's wrong with that?
Well, because if I went to school to study early childhood, at this age, you're doing more wrong than a little bit right. When the child is not ready to learn, what's happening is that, yeah, they can learn the letters and all the basic things, but when you're asking more than they're required to do at their age, then you are setting them back for in the future not do as great. The kids that do the best is the ones that start older in kindergarten. The younger ones struggle. And once they struggle and they go to first grade, it's struggling, that gap gets bigger and bigger. It doesn't get smaller. And so that is what's happening.
Well, thank you for your phone call, and I think you touched on a lot of the concerns that I have so often when you look at the age of kindergartners, and I think you can even go, I might be wrong on this, but depending on where your birthday lands, 4 to 6 is kind of that range, but largely you're about 5 years old, and amongst five-year-olds, not all five-year-olds learn or are on the same plane because that is such a young age. 6 months can make a huge difference in a child's learning capacity. So when you have a full day kid versus a half day kid, then you're probably going to have some huge learning gaps that you're going to have to address eventually.
So right now, Utah has, I'm just going to say it, it's an equal access issue on its hands, because you've allowed for some funding for some school districts to offer full day kindergarten, but you've cut out other districts because you're not providing the funding. And that's why State Board of Education, or one of the reasons why State Board of Education, is going back to lawmakers in January to ask for an additional $51 million to give it as an option. So all children, no matter where they live, no matter what their socioeconomic status is, will have access to all-day kindergarten in their neighborhood school. And I think you've opened up that can of worms, Utah. So if you're not going to offer it to every child across the state, or as an option to every family across the state, then you got to withdraw the others. You can't offer it to just some and not all. That's my view.
Russ and Heber, thanks for calling in. Russ, where do you land? Do you think that all-day kindergarten, is this better for the parents or is it better for the kids?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely better for the parents, and but I do think it's becoming necessary for the parents. And when we lived in England, and I was stationed out there with the Air Force when my child was four. And in England, they start kids at school at four instead of five. And so we were debating if we should start our kid at four. And right at that time, about 2011, the University of Cambridge out in England did a big study. And they studied if it was better for kids at four or five to start school. And they showed that kids that started at five quickly caught up to the four-year-old, the ones that started at four, and then surpassed them. They felt like the kids that started earlier got a little burnt out. And so then we were happy to start him at five. And he's done very well in school. But with inflation and the way that homes are less affordable now, food, we're becoming a society where more and more both parents are going to have to work. So I think it benefits the parents, but I think that we're becoming where we need to help these parents out, because mothers and fathers are going to have to work the way the economy is going.
Thanks, Russ. I appreciate your phone call and appreciate your service as well. Russ calling us from Heber this morning, and he brings up a great point with the cost of homes right now. Well over, $500,000-$600,000 along the Wasatch Front. The cost of daycare, the cost of food, the cost of gas. Hopefully that's temporary, but we've been saying that for a year or more. Yeah, it's such a financial stress to come up with that $500-$700 a month. It's probably way more than that now to fund daycare for children, that this would financially help families.
Yeah, I have
not just the parents it helps. It's you know, look, you got, if you're raising kids, you're paying for them too. So if you run out of money, you run out of money. Right? You don't just run out of money for yourself, you run out of money for the entire family. So this is a holistic family issue, not just a kids versus parents issue.
Well, what I hear you saying though, that's more of a daycare issue, that's a financial issue. All I care about right now is what's the best way to educate our children, because that is the goal and that is the job of schools. It's not to be daycare. It is to be educators. And if there is a better way to educate our kids, then we should follow that. And if it's better to start kids later, if it's better to ease them into it.
But do we have any sound studies? I mean, we had the phone call from the teacher, Abby, who said she felt it was better. You know, it was difficult on kids. Just we're trying to teach them too much in kindergarten.
Yeah,
as it is. But
and I pulled up as Russ had talked about that University of Cambridge study. I pulled it up on online, and it says the research evidence overwhelmingly supports a later start to formal education. I think that is true in some cases. I think there's differing opinions. I've seen other research that says that kids get a great boost by starting earlier. But it's definitely a conversation we got to keep having.
Dave and Dejanovic a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM at 1160 AM.
The Utah Drought.
If you've checked out the Great Salt Lake lately, especially this summer, you may be cheering about Senator Mitt Romney's bill. KSL.com, the headline says, Mitt Romney's bill funding millions per year to study the Great Salt Lake has sailed through the Senate.
It's because we love to pass studies. We love to fund studies. How many times have you seen an environmental impact statement or a study up Little Cottonwood Canyon, about a Big Cottonwood Canyon, down the Mountain View Corridor or Legacy Highway? Like, we love our EISs. Are they worth it? Because 5 years from now, we probably have a pretty good idea what's happening with with the Great Salt Lake, right?
So the bill earmarks $5 million a year over the next 5 years, as you said, for the U.S. Geological Survey to study saline lakes throughout the Great Basin. So it's not just the Great Salt Lake. It's other lakes as well. And it's just $5 million each year. I'm not sure, first of all, if we've got 5 years left in our lake to sit back and study it. And second of all, I'm not sure $5 million divided between a bunch of saline lakes across, you know, the Great Basin, how far is that going to go? It costs a little bit more than that. I don't know the answers to this. I do know it got through the Senate. And one of the House sponsors, which is our very own Utah Representative Blake Moore, told KSL at night when he called in why this study is important.
And it helps almost, you know, get them to the best data-driven decision-making you can get to. I think Governor Cox put out a great statement as part of this media over the last few days where he said, you know, this actually helps fill several gaps, one of them being in the study and the science of hydrology. We've got lots of ideas and plans going forward. And so it's just going to help solidify, are we going on the right track or is there a different direction that we need to move?
Now, it might cost millions of dollars to do the study, but when there's an environmental disaster, that can cost billions of dollars. I think specifically of Lake Owens in California, essentially dried up. It's a pretty small lake, Deb, 1,200 acres. The Great Salt Lake is 1 million acres. So this is a small little lake. It dries up. Dust is up in the air. They've spent $2 billion dealing with the dusty Owens Lake.
Let's ask Professor Kevin Perry. He's the department chair of Astrospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. Good morning once again.
For having me on.
Okay, let's dive into this. Let me ask you this question. Do we have 5 years to study what's going on with the Great Salt Lake?
So the big difference between the federal legislation and what's going on at the state is that water rights and the control of the water is largely a state issue. So at the federal level, there's not much they can do except for provide money for studies. And the real boots on the ground changes have to happen here at the state level. But that being said, there are many, many aspects of the Great Salt Lake and other saline lakes that we really are understudied, and we really don't understand that this study, this funding will go a long way towards reducing the uncertainties associated with the hazards associated with these drying up lakes.
Now, I might be asking a cat if they like mice with this question, but can you talk about the importance of $5 million? I mean, what's an appropriate amount of money? Because I don't know if $25 million over the next 5 years is a lot or a little. It sounds like a lot to do a study.
Yeah, so just to put it into perspective, the state of Utah has been investing about $250,000 a year to study the Great Salt Lake. And that allows about 2 to 3 very small research projects to occur each year. And that's being funded through the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. This federal legislation will increase the amount of funding by about 20%, or by a factor of 20, not 20%, and will allow researchers from around the entire United States. We can pull in expertise from all over the United States to help deal with these very important issues.
Professor Kevin Perry is the department chair of Atmospheric Sciences. I'm going to get that out. It's still Monday at the University of Utah. He's been on the line with us before, diving into the Great Salt Lake and the potential consequences. And you've been sounding the alarm on this. I went back to news stories for several years. And remind us what the potential consequences are for Salt Lake City and Utah if this lake, if our lake continues to dry up.
So there are many issues. There's economic issues. There are ecological issues with the birds. But what I've been focusing in on is health impacts associated with dust. And we know that as the lake has dried up, it's exposed more than 800 square miles of lake bed. And when the winds are strong and the surface is dry, that dust can then be moved into the surrounding communities. That dust, when it comes in the forms of plumes that block out the sun, is hazardous to breathe regardless of what it's made out of. But my research has also identified that there are high concentrations of arsenic in that soil that would not be good to breathe if it were bioavailable. But this goes back to the study part. We don't know if the arsenic poses an actual hazard or not, because we don't yet know how often people are exposed to it, what the concentrations are when they breathe it, and whether or not it's bioavailable and can get absorbed into your bloodstream. Those are important research questions that we need to address in order to understand whether or not the lake is posing an actual health hazard.
When you look at the Great Salt Lake, and just in my lifetime, I've lived here my entire life, I've seen it so high that we have to pump it out into the West Desert, and so low right now that we're trying to figure out how we can kill all our lawns to send more water to the Great Salt Lake. How much of this is decade-to-decade problem, and how much of it is a long-term problem?
So the long-term problem is that we divert too much water from the incoming rivers, and we divert about 30% too much water. And so what's happened is, you know, it's a terminal basin lake, which means that when we have wet years, it increases. When we have a drought like we're in right now, it would decrease. But the problem is that we've been diverting too much water. And there was a study done at Utah State that said the lake is down about 17 feet, and only 6 feet of that is due to the ongoing drought. And the other 11 feet is due to the excessive water diversion.
Before we let you go, I'm sorry, you were talking about, you know, things in the air, and you said something about bioavailable. I have no idea what you meant. So can you just like quick 15-second version of what that means?
Sure. So bioavailable just means that it will interact with your body. So, you know, if you breathe in some things and they're inert and they can't get absorbed into your bloodstream, they really don't have a health effect.
Okay.
The arsenic, we don't know if it's bioavailable, if it can interact with your body or not.
And you're saying that's one of the things that could possibly come out of this study with this millions of dollars a year that Senator Mitt Romney and others have secured?
One of many things.
Okay.
We could study the.
But it sounds like kind of on terms of the priority list, that sounds pretty high up to me.
Yeah. As it does to me, but there are other things that are crucial. The entire ecosystem is on the verge of collapse in terms of the base of the food chain. The brine shrimp and the brine flies feed the millions of birds that come here. They support an industry of the brine shrimp industry. And the salinity of the southern part of the lake is so high that both of those species are having trouble reproducing. The brine flies have been studied extensively because they're economic. The brine shrimp have been studied extensively because they're economic. The brine flies we know very little about, and they're suffering from habitat loss as the lake shrinks, but they're also suffering from very high salinity. And we really don't understand exactly what the long-term impacts will be on the brine fly population.
Kevin Perry, thank you for joining us. Department Chair at the University of Utah over the atmospheric sciences. Thank you for joining us.
Straight ahead, Dave and I are going to dive into the conversation about selling your home. I think in the way home sales have gone in the last year, I mean, selling right now could be anxiety inducing. So we're going to dive into five things you can do to take the stress out of selling next.
Dave and Dujanovic. Get a quick blast of news each morning.
From Ukraine to Utah County.
You'll hear it first.
And accurately.
On KSL.
Listen weekdays between 5 and 9 to Tim and Amanda.
Utah's morning companion. Dave and Dujanovic. Dave and Dujanovic are right on the money on KSL News Radio.
This is a headline from the Washington Post. We're going to talk about it right now. Five things to know if you have to sell your home right now.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, in the last couple of years, selling your home was like immediately. You know, it happened so quickly. It was such a seller's market. Well, times are starting to swing back a little bit. Pendulum is swinging back. So it's not all the power of the seller. And the buyer maybe has a little bit of juice now.
In 2 minutes, we're going to have a live interview about staging your home for selling. And if that this helps, does this help sell it faster? But first, let's dive into some of these tips in the Washington Post. Number one, ask yourself at this point, is renting your house out better than selling it?
Yeah, and I think according to this article, and I would agree with it, if you have a low mortgage, then yeah, renting out, that might be a really good deal for you. Mm-hmm. You can pay off and then some. I can see that being very good, but not on a very expensive mortgage.
Have you ever heard the acronym OPP?
Uh-uh.
Other people's problems.
Oh.
When you become a landlord, you take on OPP, other people's problems. So it's not just about, oh, you know, I'm just going to rent my house out and this is all going to be blissful and awesome. You are going to be taking on other people's problems, and you're going to hope that they pay you rent. And you're going to hope that they don't destroy your property. Yeah. And you're going to hope that they don't party there every Saturday and Sunday so the neighbors are calling the cops. OPP, something to consider before you go, you know, is it better to rent my house out? Yeah, I think I'll rent it out. Lots to consider there. Second, is your home in top condition?
Yeah, I remember when we were seeing homes being sold around my neighborhood, some were in terrible condition.
And they were just selling.
And people are still lining up to buy, like, multiple offers on a house that needs massive renovations.
It's like, where's that front door?
Not the case anymore.
Who cares? How about those windows? Doesn't matter if they're all shattered and the roof is falling off. This is not the market we're in right now. So is the home in top condition? The third point, the third tip that the Washington Post mentions in its article about today's housing market is, be realistic about the sales price. Haggling is not a thing anymore.
Yeah, you're not necessarily going to get $40,000 over asking price on an already inflated asking price.
Can I give you Debbie's tip? Don't argue with your real estate agent. Like, your real estate agent is going to come in and they're going to tell you what other homes, what other comps, comparables in the neighborhood look like, what the landscape of the market is. And you're always going to be emotionally tied to your home. Your real estate agent is there for the business deal of it all. And you're always going to feel like, you know, I can't believe that my hardwood floors that I had sanded down and whitewashed don't make my home worth $50,000 more than what you're saying it is.
Yeah.
They're there for the business end of it. You're tied to it emotionally. So listen to what they're telling you. Because if you price a home too high, and you got to start lowering the price, that in my experience, yeah, it just looks bad on the MLS if you have to keep lowering the price of that home.
You came across some pretty good numbers earlier today. Mm-hmm. We were talking about how long it takes to sell your home. The low, wasn't it like 9 days?
Yeah.
It was 9 days to get your home sold.
Yeah.
And now it's can be up to 2 months.
It's 54 days now. So you also have to purchase yourself a pound of patience. Yeah, if it doesn't sell in 1 week, it's okay. Other homes aren't selling in 1 week right now either.
The final suggestion was be realistic about how long it takes to sell, and that maybe staging can help you sell it quicker. Staging a house drops the sell time by 33 to 50%. If you're wondering, well, what in the world is staging? That's why we have Heather Osmond. She's with Osmond Designs, also the host of the Home Show on KSL News Radio. Heather, thanks for joining us. What is staging?
Good morning, Dave and Debbie. It's so good to be on the show with you. I love real estate. I own the Osmond Design Stores in Lehi and Orem, and of course, we offer staging services as part of our furniture store. And staging is going in and making your home look its very best so that you can get the highest amount of money in the shortest amount of time. So if you think of just normal builders, production builders in the Utah market, they spend a lot of money on model homes. And there's a good reason for that. And part of that is because we're appealing to the five senses. you know, when you're looking online and you see, you know, all the stats of square footage and taxes and your built and those kinds of things, you know, that only goes so far. But when you walk into a home, it's the sights, it's the smells, it's the feeling that sometimes you can't always see on a report. So we offer a service for $100 for 1 hour. We will come in and we'll work with what you have. We'll rearrange things. I think one of the number one problems we see specifically here in Utah, because we're all about families and kids and pets and, you know, we live in our homes, but we need to declutter.
Yeah.
So oftentimes we're trying to just appeal to the masses, right? So we just need to get rid of stuff so we can make those suggestions and recommendations. And oftentimes it's just a third set of eyes that need to, you know, sometimes tell you the good and the bad about your home.
You got to be the bad guy. You got to come in and give people great advice. But so let me give you an example of, I've staged my own homes for sale every single time, Heather. But maybe in the future I should count on a service like yours. But let me give you, see if you tell me if I did it right. Take out all the personal family photos and all of the quilts my great 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 grandmother quilted that I had thrown over the back of a chair. Really take out, actually moved out extra furniture before and got it out of the house so it felt more spacious and open. I left the lights on. I even bought a basket of lemons at one point to kind of give the table a little pop of color on a gloomy weekend when we were having showings. Do any of those check the boxes for you? Okay.
Girlfriend, you check all the boxes. Oh, I think that's amazing. I think sometimes just less is more. So just getting rid of stuff and making sure that your home appeals to the masses. So we want to just neutralize everything. Sometimes, you know, here in Utah, we have a lot of religious art. Sometimes that doesn't always go well for everyone. So, you know, have minimal things, personal photos of your family and things. You really just want that buyer to come in and visualize themselves and their family living in your home. But number one, I love just to start on the outside. I think that curb appeal is everything. I actually have a background as being a real estate agent. I've been an agent for 27 years, and that's actually what propelled me into being a designer and opening my furniture store. But I would go into homes and just be horrified that there were just diapers all over the ground and, you know, just crazy things, just simple things like changing out the light bulbs, making sure that things are maintained, cleaning the baseboards, cleaning the carpets. You'd be surprised at how much more money you can get for your home if you just do the simple little basics.
Heather Osman, thank you so much for joining us
with
Osman Designs. Another thing that we didn't have time to really dive into, Debbie, but there is a way to stage a home essentially where you move out of the house. You know, you live with somebody else, and then you move out all of your furniture and everything, and you have a professional come in, bring in new furniture, and literally stage the house kind of like you would a model home.
Huh.
You can't live in there. You can't sit on these couches, but it is used just to kind of show you this is the best version of your house with a brand new couch versus my 10-year-old couch that I have in there right now.
Straight ahead. Before we had a 40-hour work week, it was a 70 or an 80-hour work week, right? Yeah, it was. How about this? How about if we go down to a 32-hour work week?
It is for Dave and Degenovic, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM at 1160 AM. Utah at Work. In-depth coverage on KSL News Radio.
Is it time to change the same old 9 to 5, 5 days a week?
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living.
To 32 hours a week. 33 companies, where do you see this in The Hill? Or this is on News Nation's website.
Yeah.
33 companies tested this 32-hour, 4-day work week. This sounds glorious, quite frankly. I'm out because I'm going to start my work week tomorrow. I'm out.
No, this is super fun because the conversation we've had in the past is four tens, right? That you still work full time. You're going to get 40 hours, but you're just going to squeeze it into 4 days. Number one, I love the 4 day work week. You and I do the 4 day work week right now. We love it. We're off Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Doug Wright, I hope you do the movie show till you're 90. I love our 4 day work week. The only thing that's going to ruin the 4 day work week is the jealousy of everybody else.
Oh, like
that are showing up 5 days a week.
Yeah. So these 33 companies tested this 32-hour 4 day work week, and they not one of them they say planned to switch back.
Yeah, this is great. Great news. Now this is interesting, Deb, because it's not just a 4 day work week; it's 32 hours.
Yeah.
So it's a reduction. It's not just squeezing in longer days.
Right.
It's saying 8 hour days, but only 4 days a week.
10 hour work days, I think, are still tricky because you've got the commute time usually, unless you're working from home, which I know a lot of people are doing right now. But
good
you got
point.
The 10 hour, so you got the commute and basically,
and lunch.
Yeah, by the time you get home, it's
12 hours.
Yeah, it's 12 hours or longer, depending on how long your commute is. So. This 32-hour work week sounds glorious to me. But are people willing to work harder and faster to get the job done in 32 hours? That's a question employers are going to want to have an answer to.
Yeah, and I think this is very, very interesting that of these 33 companies that tested it, that they reduced your hours worked during, they didn't change the pay. You're still getting paid 100%, right? But they dropped it from a 40-hour work week down to a 32-hour work week in 4 days. Every one of those companies are going to stick with it. Why did they decide that? Because obviously it has not affected their productivity. And that's got to be a surprise to everybody.
Well, I'm not surprised. I do think if we're given a lot – okay, you and I have been on deadlines for – our whole life, probably 50 years between the two of us, 50 years of working on deadline. And I can get the same story written in 8 hours that I can get written in 8 minutes. Right? Because I know there's a deadline and I'm capable.
Yeah.
I just don't get as many coffee breaks. Right? I don't get to dilly-dally as much. Dilly-dally, is that? Yeah, it's not dally-dilly, it's dilly-dally. Okay. Yeah, I do feel like when we are given a stopwatch or time, or here's the thing, that there's cheese at the end of this maze, and the cheese is you get Fridays off, right? So if you know you're going to get Fridays off, you better believe you're going to work harder.
You make a great point, and this is a very important part of this research and this study. The expectation was you have to still get all of your work done. 100% productivity, but you have to do it in 80% of the time, you know. So the argument was like you do
eight
not
hours less.
Yeah, we're going to cut your day down. You still have to get the job done at the same standard. And with that understanding, people were doing it. Kind of like what you said. They were staying more focused. They were more diligent on the hours that they were working because the promise was, well, you're going to get Fridays off.
There's a reward. And
yes.
The reward is, woohoo. Friday morning rolls around, you can look out the window and it's snowing and you don't have to commute in. You're just going to be at home. You're going to get your laundry done Friday morning. You're going to get your grocery shopping done. And then Saturday and Sunday are yours to do with what you want.
I think for a very long time, and you and I, and I think all of our listeners have been in jobs where they grind you down. It is 60-hour work weeks. And if 60-hour work weeks are good, 80-hour work weeks are better, right?
We'll just get out of you what they can.
Yeah. More hours, more hours, more hours, more hours, right? That was the idea is I'm just going to work you and work you and work you. But what they're finding is just because you're working more hours does not necessarily mean you're being more productive.
Now, what's the punishment for employers who say, hey, we know this is a gift to you. 32 hours a week is a gift. So if we want to tap you for that 33rd and 34th and 35th, up to 40 hours a week, do they have to pay overtime? because now 32 hours a week is would be considered full time. This is my read of it. 32 hours a week is full time now. You get to work 8 hours, 4 days a week, and then you're done. But what if your employer's not done and they keep slipping back into those old bad habits of like, well, we'll just contact you anytime we feel like it. They have to pay you overtime.
That, I think, would solve a lot of the problem and a lot of the pressure to keep tapping into somebody. Because it is a total mindset. You have to change the way you view working. Now, the argument is, if I create a better work-life balance by requiring you to be here at the office less, work less hours, have more days off, then your work-life balance is so much better that you are just a more productive worker in the hours that you are there. Now, it's going to be hard not to slip into those old school habits.
Oh, yeah, because we're used to it.
Yeah.
One of the things in the article that stood out to you, and Dave and I are talking about this, cut 33 companies tried a 32-hour work week, which means 8 hours a day, 4 days a week, and they don't plan to go back. You thought that the 70% of employees need a 10 to 50% pay bump to return to a 40-hour work week was is it greedy or fascinating?
Both. Yeah. No, definitely both.
So, yeah. So if you cut to 32 hours, what you're going to need to entice you to go back to 40 hours is a big old pay bump.
Because once you've done the 4-day work week, it is so hard to go back to a 5-day work week. Once you're used to working 32 hours, it's hard to go back to working 40, 50, 60 hours. So what these employees are saying, for the ones that have already experienced this 4-day work week, you're going to have to give me a huge pay bump, somewhere between 10 and 50% to get me to return to that 40-hour work week, working 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. So they're willing to sacrifice money. Or they're going to have to require more money to get me to go back to work 5 days a week.
So you give me one benefit of a 32-hour, 4-day week, and I'll give you one. You go first.
The benefit, I think, will absolutely keep you more energized at work, more passionate, happier. Okay. All of these things we know create a more productive employee. It's why they offer free cereal at a lot of companies or free soda. They know if they can keep you happy and keep you caffeinated, then you're going to be more productive. How about you?
I would say my one is your home life is much more even keel.
Yeah.
Because remember when we were both working full time plus. I mean, it's never just 40 hours, right? I mean, I used to call it avalanche conditions in the laundry room around the clock. Like, you could walk in any moment and trigger an avalanche of clothing. And we'd have to send in search and rescue to find you. We were never caught up. Like grocery shopping, we're always behind. Laundry, homework, everything. And I always used to say, if I just had one day a week to just focus on family chores, not family stuff, because Saturdays were always activities and Sundays we were always busy with stuff, whether it was church or other activities, just stuff around the house, our lives would be so much more in balance. Straight ahead, we're going to get the mayor of Provo. She's calling the line live because they went several years ago to a 4-day work week. Now, what I don't know is that 32 hours a week or is that 40 hours, is that 4 10-hour days?
Yeah.
But we're going to ask her how that's shaken out for them in Provo. Straight ahead.
Dujanovic. Start your mornings productively with important updates on breaking news,
traffic, and reliable weather.
You'll get it all on KSL from 5 to 9 with Tim and Amanda.
Utah's morning companions for news.
Dave and Dujanovic. Utah at work. In-depth coverage on KSL News Radio.
Dave and I diving into the discussion about a 4-day work week and not 4 10s. That's kind of the future of work weeks. It's a 32-hour work week where it's 4 days a week for 8 hours a day. We spotted this story on News Nation, and what they did is 33 companies tested a 4-day work week, and not one of them plans to switch back to the old traditional 5 days, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day.
It's because it is amazing. If you've ever worked a 4-day work week, it is like a gift every single week. A three-day weekend? Are you kidding me? It is glorious.
Utah, well, probably UDOT too, did test drive this back in 2009, 2010, 11, four 10-hour shifts. So the state of Utah, you were still doing work. If you work for them, you're still working 40 hours a week, but they did 10-hour shifts. And workers reported great work-life satisfaction. 60% of workers said they were more productive than before, but eventually this went away. It went away when they went back to...
It's because of jealousy. I'm absolutely convinced, Deb. It's jealousy. Everyone that works 4-10s gets bitten by all the coworkers that have to work 5 days a week, and they just, make little snide comments. Even though we know, you look at the research, everybody's happier with four-day work weeks.
Provo Mayor Michelle Cafusi, live on the line. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning.
So you guys have had a four-day work week in Provo for quite some time. Is it 4-10s or how does that work?
Yeah, so we are 4-10s, and then except for customer service, cemetery, of course, police and fire 24/7. So we manage our 4-10s. In a way that the residents are the priority and are constantly taken care of.
Okay, so why did you decide to go 4-10s?
So it's interesting because for us, it's all about our residents and convenience for our residents who need to come earlier before they go to work or stop in later after work. And with that, we have this great mission statement. It's exceptional care for an exceptional community. And Provo City just really believes that. We believe that if you're a working mom, and I have been my whole life, that 7 o'clock to run in and have a question about a utility bill, I can do that. But if you open at 9 and close at 5, that's when I'm at work. And so then I'm in a little bit of a conundrum. So it has really worked well for us to have we are staffed in here at 7, and we do not leave till 6 p.m. And the compressed work week program, it has been loved, literally loved by everyone in the community and in the city, because we still make sure our citizens are taken care of.
Michelle Cafusi is the mayor of Provo. Live on the line, we're talking about a condensed work week after a study came out regarding 33 companies who tested a 32-hour work week, and they all say we're not planning on going back because the productivity stayed the same. So do your workers like it? It sounds like they do.
It's interesting. They absolutely value it. In fact, whenever we open up a position, when I ask them, when it finally rises to this level, I'll say, what made you interested in Provo? Without a doubt, their top three reasons are the 4-10s. They love it. It opens up an opportunity for moms and dads to Friday, go be the parent that goes on the field trip with your kids. You know, go have school lunch, take a longer break on a weekend and take your family. The quality of life and the work-life balance to me as this mayor is so critical, especially with the mental health issues. And this four-day work week just makes that flourish. The break, the longer break, a lot of holidays fall on Mondays, so therefore now they've even extended. And I want my employees to be able to participate in their family events and activities and come back to work excited to be back and work rested and ready to work.
As much as I love having a three-day work week, I listen, and I've done this. I've worked 4-10s before. It does turn into a long day. As you mentioned, you guys arrive at 7 and leave at 6. You know, you add a little commute time on each end there. You're looking at a 12-hour day. 4 days a week, that's a demanding schedule. Would Provo ever consider scaling back to maybe a 32-hour work week?
Well, it's interesting. I've asked the employees, and we do survey our employees quite often. And as of now, it's still a no. They are still content with this. We have a wonderful, and I really push the mental health and the physical fitness and the natural light components with my employees. I tell them to take that hour, and even if they need to wiggle a little bit on that hour and go a little longer, get in the work. We have a beautiful workout room, we have a beautiful rec center. Get outside, you know, break the day up. You are exactly right. It is makes for a long day if you do not get that hour, that little hour plus, and break this day up.
Do you have any jealousy? Do you have any people?
Yeah. Are other cities jealous of Provo, Mayor? Are
totally,
other cities jealous? Yeah.
Totally jealous. I mean, they just cannot believe I'm pulling this off. And because also, I think a lot of it too is who your leader is. Does your leader say, I appreciate and love you so much that I want you to be healthy? I want you to go to our rec center. I give all of my employees free access to all of our facilities. Go walk around the track at the rec center if it's a blizzard. Just get out and do something. And I want them to be happy and healthy. Happy, healthy employees is what makes Provo's magic right now that's going on, all this energy. So, yeah, I'm all about it, but a lot of it has to do with leadership.
Okay. You talk about leadership, and I'll ask you this question. And, again, we're talking to Provo Mayor Michelle Cafusi. We're talking about a four-day work week. That's what Provo does. They do a four-day work week. When I talk about jealousy kind of torpedoing these great ideas, do you work a four-day work week or do you get sucked into more days?
A little stinker. So, no, I work every day. Being the mayor of Provo, and I just told my family this, that it is not a job. I'm never off the clock, and it's a lifestyle. So that's how I look at it. And I just have to tell myself, I worked really hard for this seat, and I have a lot of energy. So it is working for me. But it is, you are never off the clock, and you're just, it's a lifestyle. You're the mayor no matter what, no matter where you go.
But should that be the case, though? I mean, let's be honest. Even though it is, quote unquote, public service, should it take up every waking moment of your life, or should you be able to have 3 days off or 2 days off? I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation.
I don't think it is either. I think it's more, again, my personality. I have this work ethic that is exhausting for people to be around me, and I know it. They tell me all the time, and I think maybe other mayors would burn out or would say, I have got to take time. I'm not there yet. I'm sure if the time were to come where I felt like I needed the time off, I've overworked. I mean, I probably, if you were to keep track, I'm sure I'm paying to be mayor at this point.
Right.
But anyways, I think so much of it depends on the leader, who you are as a leader, and what your energy levels and desires are to get accomplished in your little window of time you get to serve.
Well, we appreciate you joining us, Provo Mayor Michelle Cafusi. Thank you for joining us. That's my worry, though, Deb. When you have leaders, when you have, whoever your manager is, putting in these 5, 6, 7, day work weeks, working 80 hours, it's very hard to look at your employees and say, oh, you're going to be fine just working 4 days.
I want to let you know, stay tuned, because we're going to go live to Moscow, Idaho, as that Idaho murder mystery of those four college students continues. We've got a live report.
Dave and Dejanovic, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM at 1160 AM.
In a moment, we're going to take you live to Moscow, Idaho, to talk more about the stabbing of those four University of Idaho students. And reading up on this over the weekend, Dave, it seems like there's been some newer developments, one of which is there was a sixth roommate who's been cleared. Because police say the person was on the lease, but they haven't been at the home since the beginning of school.
And I'm mixed here, Deb. I don't know whether the police department is just doing an incredible job of keeping things under wraps, that they're following leads, or if they've hit a dead end. I don't know, because they are not talking. I don't know obviously there is a killer on the loose. Is it one person? Is it multiple people? Was it some sort of murder-suicide? I don't know. But this small town, Moscow, Idaho, is shaken.
Now, remember, there were two roommates in addition to the four who were stabbed. And those two have released a statement. And it was read during, I believe, Brian, good morning. Was that read at a vigil for the for the family or for the students who were killed? It's Brian Enton with News Nation. He's live on the line out of Idaho right now.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Debbie and Dave. Yeah, that was read at a church service remembering the victims. It was the first time we'd heard a statement from the surviving roommates, essentially just saying that, you know, their thoughts are with the family and just sort of how torn up they are about the whole thing.
So have they given us any new information?
So you mentioned it. I mean, police have been extremely tight-lipped. Last we've heard from them on Friday, no known suspect, no persons of interest. They don't have a suspect on surveillance video. It's been 3 weeks now. We just hit the 3 week mark, and the families are becoming super frustrated, wanting more information, feeling like they don't know. Is there something big in the background that the cops know, or is this sort of becoming a cold case? We confirmed last night, an interesting new nugget, that Kaylee Gonzalez, who is one of the victims, who was in the top third floor bedroom in the same bed as her best friend, Maddie, that she had significantly more brutal injuries than her friend Maddie, which is interesting because there's this whole question of who the target was, if there was a target, who that person was. And so the fact that she had more severe injuries could certainly be an important part of the investigation.
Well, police have gone back and forth. It seems, I mean, maybe it's not police have gone back and forth, but it seems like prosecutors have said at one point it may not be a targeted attack. Police are standing by that they say it is a targeted attack. What do you know, Brian?
Yeah, it's been really confusing. On News Nation all week, we've, you know, been talking to police and the prosecutor all of last week. You know, initially they said targeted attack. Then I interviewed the prosecutor on News Nation, and he said that he didn't believe that the victims were targeted, but that the actual house was targeted. Then the next day, police came out and said that was an internal miscommunication between the prosecutor and the detectives, and that they did believe it was targeted, but that they were still waiting on more evidence. So all of this kind of back and forth, again, has really frustrated the families because there hasn't sort of been a consistent message. And so they're starting to hit the point now at the 3 week mark where they're just sort of demanding more information.
How is the University of Idaho responding to this?
So it's very, it's almost like there's a cloud over the campus. You know, they gave students after Thanksgiving the option of coming back or staying online or going online learning because they knew people would be scared. We're told about a fourth of the students did not come back. They're encouraging students to walk together in pairs. You don't really see any women walking alone. Mostly people stay in groups on campus. You know, we've heard from people who even put extra locks on their doors. A lot of people got Ring cameras, and no one really goes outside at night alone, especially just because there's this feeling among a lot of people that this killer could literally just be walking among them.
Brian Enton is with News Nation. He's live joining us from Moscow, Idaho, where the investigation is still ongoing into the brutal murders of four University of Idaho students, still unsolved, still no suspect, still no person of interest named. Brian, I saw you live on News Nation. I believe it was either over the weekend or last week. And there was some sort of a strange 911 call that you spoke of some sort of an incident in the field near the fraternity house where two of the victims were last seen at 9 o'clock in the evening. Anything ever come of that? And what was that 911 call all about?
Yeah, this was really eerie. So the house where the houses where the murders happen is just very close, maybe half a block in a very dense area, a lot of apartment buildings to right where the fraternity and sorority houses are. And so we went over the call logs for the night / early morning of the murder 3 weeks ago. And there was this 911 call in a field right next to one of these fraternity houses that's very close to the house. It was an alcohol call. Turns out police said it had nothing to do with what happened at the house, but what's so just eerie and kind of disturbing is that police were called and responded to this field around the same time that the murders were happening. So is it possible the police were very close by when it was happening or shortly before or after? We don't really know, but we know that they were in the proximity of the house.
Brian, is there a sense at all, one way or the other, whether police are making progress and they're just being tight-lipped about it, or is there a sense that they've run out of clues to chase?
So, I mean, that's a really good, that's like the million-dollar question that the families want answered. I can tell you the last time I sat down with the prosecutor, which was on Tuesday, so it's been a little while, I got the sense from him that he was being totally open and honest, that they basically truly did not have a suspect and needed the public's help and did not have a person of interest and did not have anyone on camera. And that's what they continue to say in the press releases too. But, you know, just looking him in the eye, like, and he's a, you know, an old timer. He's been here forever. This is a small town. I didn't get the sense that he would be lying to me about that or trying to, you know, protect something. I felt like he was really being open and honest, but that was almost a week ago now. So hopefully the hope is that there is something behind the scenes. But we don't know, and the families don't know.
What are you chasing this week? And for example, I'd heard that there was going to be some sort of a big forensic evidence dump potentially this week. I mean, maybe you know, you probably know a lot more about that than I do. Was I mishearing that?
Yeah, so they released at the end of last week some of the forensic, not to us, but to the police, that the information had come back from the lab. Okay. It's going to continue to come back. They're not going to tell us that. What I'm really chasing after is it's interesting because you don't see this in a lot of cases. The police have released a list of people that they've cleared, including, you know, one of the ex-boyfriends of the girls, you know, the other roommates, someone at the food truck they were at. So there's like five or six people on this list. And this is something that frustrates the families. They've released the list, but they're not giving specifics about what the alibis were. Why did they put them on this cleared list? So that's something we're chasing after on News Nation, to kind of get like the background info. Like, how did they actually clear these people so quickly?
Brian Anton, thank you for joining us live from Moscow, Idaho, with News Nation. Thanks, Brian.
I mean, we'd love to have you back on the air to find out. That's a great question. It's so rare to find a list of cleared.
Yeah.
A cleared list,
right,
of people, which, you know, maybe that's something that more police departments should do is, you know, hey, we've cleared these people. You can stop knocking on their doors now and stop asking them questions. But why have they cleared them?
Yeah, and is that too much information? Because you'll see from police, they try to hold back certain information so that when they're doing their questioning, they're talking to the suspects, they're not just regurgitating information that's come out on news sources. So it's a technique to purposely hold back certain elements of the case so that when they're in these private conversations, they can find out, okay, does this person really know what happened, or are they just talking about stuff they heard on the news?
Straight ahead, we're going to dive into this conversation about the president's student loan forgiveness plan. The Supreme Court came out and said, we'll have a decision on this case that's before us by June. I think they said by June.
Don't rush into it. Take your time. We're on pins and needles.
Dave and Dujanovic.
You can catch info anywhere.
But KSL News Radio is a dependable source.
We invite you to join us weekdays between 5 and 9.
Tim Hughes and Amanda Dixon.
Utah's morning companions for news. Just a moment.
Dave and Dujanovic.
We're going to talk about something that all of you probably have in your home, or at least know somebody who does. Alexa. The Street, which is like an online website, is reporting that, here's the headline, Amazon needs to kill Alexa. Maybe exit Echo devices.
Bite your tongue, The Street.
It goes on to say that the online retail giant had a plan to own your living room and it didn't work.
Yes and no. I would totally agree with part of that. How about that? Alexa is awesome. Let's not pretend like Alexa is not awesome. Can it do everything you want it to do? No. Does it understand 5% of what I actually say? Yes. Like, mostly Alexa is just a fight to enunciate, re-enunciate, re-describe, re-ask a question. It's a lot like journalism.
Did you ever have a fight with yourself about getting one of these devices that it's kind of tapping into your world?
No.
It's like a speaker in your home that is digesting and collating everything you say and sending it off yonder into the black hole of the internet.
Yeah, that's exactly what is happening, and I have no problem with it. I love it. Are you kidding? When I say play music, I want it to play my music, music that I like. That's a win. It's the artificial intelligence component freaks some people out. No, I like it.
I just didn't think there was anything that Jeff Bezos could fail at. But is the Echo the one thing that's just not going to go his way? Now, this is that little speaker. Mine's around. I'm going to start speaking in plural and see if you can. Mine are all these round things, right? I mean, are they all
Echo
the
dots.
Same? Like, well, yeah, but aren't there other shapes now?
It's a hockey puck.
It's like a that's a good way of putting it, Dave.
Yeah, it's straight up a hockey puck.
Two times the size maybe of a hockey puck, but in case you're the one person listening who doesn't have one, you can talk to it, right? You just say, Alexa. I'm whispering now so we don't trigger all the Alexa. You could say play KSL News Radio. I do that every morning, listen to Tim and Amanda when I'm getting ready. They're cheap. I think the last one I bought was about $15. Might have even been cheaper than that. It hooks to the internet, and here's what I use it for. I'm going to bounce this off you, Dave. I use it to constantly keep track of my shopping list.
Okay.
If the minute I run out of something in the refrigerator, I just shout at her and she logs it on the shopping list and I don't have to run to the post-it note. I no longer have like 30 post-it notes all over with, you know, spaghetti sauce on them because I'm trying to write down what I need. I constantly listen to music.
Hold on. Let me follow up on that shopping list.
Oh, no.
Where does the shopping list go?
Or you just say you created, you didn't know about this?
No, I do not use.
Oh, I love it when I have a light bulb moment over Dave's head.
A life hack. Okay.
Yeah,
how does
no,
it work?
It's, you can do a shopping list on Alexa. Okay. You can say, Alexa, start a shopping list.
Okay.
Like a grocery shopping list.
And then
list.
You can add to it throughout the week?
Oh, you can add to it every minute you want to. So I'll say, you know, Alexa, add paper towel. Alexa, add such and such to my shopping list.
Then where does it live?
It lives on my app on my phone, my Alexa app on my phone.
Oh, so you got
to
pull up
your
app.
Yeah, I'll show it to you right now. In fact, let me pull up my Alexa app. Oh, I've timed out on that. I guess I have a time limit on my Alexa app. I don't know why. Here we go. So see my shopping list, Dave?
Okay.
It's that icon right there. I open it up.
Oh.
And then it says I need garlic. Who doesn't need garlic?
Yeah.
I need gluten-free syrup, peanut butter powder. I need gluten-free flour because I cook for my daughter, you know, and she's gluten-free. Protein shakes. I need iced tea bags. I need pasta. I need dog bones. I don't need those anymore. See, here's what I do. I just click that little box right there, and it eliminates
and it's
dog
gone.
Bones.
And
yeah,
it's
so
gone.
I take that to the grocery store. We ran out of time. We now know.
I didn't know you can make a shopping list. That's awesome. So, how in the world can they think that Echo Dots or whatever it is, whatever the Amazon Alexa you have, isn't a smashing success? Like, okay, I get it. Sometimes it has no idea what I'm saying. Here's an example of a man asking Alexa for urgent help.
Alexa, I need medical assistance immediately.
I added medical assistance immediately to your shopping list.
Oh, no.
Is that a joke or is that?
Hope he didn't really need medical assistance.
Yeah, there's times when she has no idea what you're talking about.
So Alexa's good for setting a timer. I do that all the time when I'm cooking.
Yes.
I say, Alexa, set a 10-minute timer instead of having to click on the microwave.
Yep.
I do the shopping list. We did that. We know how that works. I play music on Alexa all the time.
Yep.
But what this article is saying where Alexa has failed is interpreting what we want. And so you cannot, it was designed to be married with Amazon, right? Our favorite shopping app. And you could say, hey, Alexa, buy me a 6-pack of paper towels.
Yeah.
And then Alexa would, without you looking at the paper towels or anything, or going to your app on your phone, would automatically order you up a half dozen paper towels and deliver them to your door. But the problem is people are finding, I don't know what brand I'm getting. And maybe I like, you know, the generic brand, or maybe I like the Brawny Man. I mean, right?
Yeah.
And I want that.
You may not know what the cost is.
That's another good point. So where Amazon's Alexa Echo is failing is in that. People are finding it's just that AI part of it is just not fitting our lifestyles.
Some things are just easier on a computer or easier on your phone, and you can't get around it. I think the idea ultimately was that it will be able to read your mind and know exactly what you're talking about.
Fine. We're not even, they can't even understand what I'm saying when I'm like, play KSL News Radio. Sometimes it'll say like something back to me like, I'm a schmale and I'm playing Kajal. I mean, it's like the weirdest thing.
Yeah, it doesn't understand.
It's something so simple.
But again, you say it's so simple. But imagine, this thing is trying to interpret 8 billion people on this earth in multiple languages. Fact that it doesn't understand you the same way it understands me.
Then it needs to get out of my home, right? It needs to get out of my home. And that's the point of this conversation where we began it with this headline is Amazon needs to kill Alexa and maybe exit Echo devices. If you're not going to get me 100% of the time, it's like a relationship. Get out of my life.
Every time I talk to somebody, it's always, huh, what? We do the exact same thing. We're holding Alexa to an unreal standard. Let's celebrate how amazing she is. And for the 12% that she actually understands us, because that is incredible.
Are you ever, ever, ever going to cancel Alexa or the Echo? Do you ever have the urge to? There's times when I feel like ripping it out of the wall.
Oh, yeah. Especially when I want her to like stop playing music and she just keeps playing music, I will yell at the top of my lungs.
What about when you use your alarm, your morning alarm?
Yeah. Yeah. I just learned this, that if you whisper to Alexa, she'll whisper back. Like, I kid you not, nobody knew this until my 12-year-old son came up and said, Dad, did you know if you whisper to Alexa, she'll whisper back?
I knew it.
I said, that's creepy. And seriously?
It happens.
And it works.
I had that in the middle of the night once. I woke up and I said, I would say, Alexa, what time is it? And she used her whisper voice and I about fell out of bed.
You're like, creepy.
It scared me. 50 million homes in the U.S. have an Amazon Echo.
I have
as
8.
Of last year. What?
I have one in every room. I have one in the garage. I have them all over the place because they're like $15.
Do you feel as though the technology is going to get better so it does serve its purpose or its original purpose,
yeah,
which was it will know like everything about,
yes,
your home and order you stuff automatically off of Amazon without you even having to look at it?
Yep. All of the above. That's exactly what's going to happen. We're anxious for it to be right now. It's getting there. It's getting slowly better. Very, very slowly.
News. Dave and DeGenevieve.
We're talking about gas prices right now. It's our favorite default subject.
It's easy to talk about. It is easy to talk about because every single one of us hates, mm-hmm, gasoline. Mm-hmm. Just with every fiber of our
being. They are falling. I noticed last week on my drive home that there was a gas station on Bangor. I'm not going to give you the exact location because I don't want to see y'all there today. It was $3.69 a gallon.
Ooh.
And I was super excited. But if you own a diesel truck, you like to roll coal in your diesel. Yeah, it's up. And I posted that picture that I took of that gas station somewhere in West Valley City. And I said, what do you notice about this photo? And most people said diesel price, $5.63 a gallon right now.
Isn't that wild? I mean, that is just a huge
number.
That's
$2 more.
Yeah.
That's $2 more than regular unleaded.
Yeah, I'm looking at AAA. AAA tracks all the gas prices. And you're right. Diesel right now, $5.63, as opposed to regular, which is about $3.78. So, yeah, just under $2 more for diesel. The worst part about diesel is if you're driving that is a terrible gas guzzler. I have yet to meet a diesel vehicle that is not a gas guzzler.
So the highest recorded price for regular unleaded this year was $5.26. That sounds like a nationwide number.
No, that's here in Utah.
Utah?
Yeah.
$5.26.
July 1st.
Oh, my gosh.
July 1st, you got hit in the face. You don't remember that?
No.
You've wiped that from your memory?
I have. Highest watermark. We're using big words here. Highest watermark for diesel, $5.75, almost $5.76, which happened right around Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So we're not far off right now from the all-time high. Now, remember, when you look out there and you're driving on the freeway and you're getting passed by semi after semi after semi,
yeah,
they all fill up with diesel, right? And they probably get somewhere between 6 and 8 miles to the gallon.
Stop it. Stop buying stuff. You stop buying stuff, we won't have all this this worry, right?
Debbie wants to have the chicken and the egg argument. I'm going to buy food, Deb.
I'm trying to do the math right now. $22.50 less to fill up my tank now than it cost me a couple of months ago in July, according to the highest price. So it's gone down about $1.50 a gallon since our high mark of $5.26, which apparently I've just totally blanked out of my mind. But I do remember offering to fill up my daughter's truck when it was super high and just praying that thing would click off, and it got over $100, Dave. And I just wanted to tell her, like, look, kid, you're on your own. I'm out.
Good luck.
I'm out. $22.50 a fill up. I have been filling up an inordinate amount lately, once a week on average. I used to fill up every other week. I don't know what's going on. I got to get to the bottom of that. That's another story. But that does save me about, what, almost $90 a month.
Yeah. Remember, the previous high all time was $4.11. That was the previous high. We are celebrating $3.80 right now, Deb. That's how messed up our minds are. Because we've just been so blasted for the last year and a half with crazy gas prices, we don't even know what bad used to be. But $3.80 is terrible.
So why are diesel prices so high? What does AAA say about diesel? Do you have that number right there?
Yeah, right now it's $5.63 in Utah a gallon.
I wonder what it is around the rest of the nation. We should fly around the rest of the country real quick and find out. I wonder what it is in, like, California.
I'll tell you right now what it is.
Oh, go for it.
I am just a click away. $5.90 in California. They had a high, though. How about this? This was back in June in California. $7.
For diesel?
Yeah, for diesel. That's their high.
Okay, so there's not enough diesel being produced right now. We're at the lowest national level since 1982. That's a long time. How old were you in 1982?
7.
Okay. I was a little older than that. I don't know. It's 15. So that's a long time ago. So, and then some analysts also say it was a result of a fire at the Philadelphia Energy Solutions in 2019, which forced that refinery to shut down. So that took out one of the Northeast's most important diesel producers. So I guess it was from 3 years ago. We're still having lingering side effects from that. And in 2020, the International Maritime Organization required most ocean ships, most ships, to replace their high sulfur bunker fuel with less polluted fuels. They turned to diesel. So supply and demand, here we go again.
Yeah.
Same old conversation.
Well, and when you don't have a supply, you can just charge more and more and more. And we're supposed to have cheaper gas, right, during the winter. The blend during the summer is more expensive. But what we're seeing right now is what I don't know if that blend happens to diesel, if they're changing it from the summer mix to the winter mix. But you're basically in the conversation within a dime of all-time highs, even though we're right here in the winter.
Let's get our truckers, if you're not driving, we know you listen all the time. 57500, text us at 57500, our KSL text line. And I want to know what it cost. If you're driving a diesel truck, I want to know what it cost for your last fill-up. And your last fill-up can't just be like a top-off, like a gallon. I don't know. I want to know, like, you had to fuel the whole entire tank. Or tanks. I'm sure there's more than one tank on those things.
Correct me if I'm wrong, truckers. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm looking up the I used to drive not a huge semi, but I had a CDL. I'd drive big trucks, but I never had a 300 gallon tank. But some of these semis will hold 300 gallons. So at 583, Debbie, for a fill up, that's $1,700. $1,700 for a fill up on one of those big semis.
How is diesel fuel impacting the price of everything?
Well, it absolutely affects everything we purchase, whether it's milk, eggs, video games. Everything ultimately is delivered by a semi-truck, right? Now, a lot is traveling on rail.
Right.
Right? They'll get you in the ballpark, but ultimately you got to load it up on a big semi, and the semi will take it the final, 50 miles, 100 miles, whatever it might be. So, yeah, everything you buy at some point was on a semi.
And how much did you say it was right now to fill up a semi? Almost $1,700?
Yeah, $1,700.
So, what was the low price for diesel? I mean, I don't know what the lowest price was, but what I'm trying to get to, Dave, is how much more are people driving, who are truckers driving semi-trucks, how much more are they paying than they were like just a year ago? 6 months ago.
Well, a year ago, diesel was $3.62. So $3.62, 300 gallons times $3.62, that's $1,000. So it's $700 more.
So you can see why, if the cost is, and it is, getting passed on to us, how much more? That's just one fill-up. Usually hundreds of dollars for a small truck, says one of our listeners at 57500. Diesel fuel price, 2001 Dodge diesel gets 21 to 22 miles a gallon. But some of them, some of them get 14 miles to the gallon. Somebody says $275 to fill up my Ram 3500. Why are you driving that thing? $275 for one fill up. You know, I'd be driving that.
That thing has some power, though.
I'd be driving that right to the car dealership to trade it in.
They might not take it at $5 and something a gallon. Like, how does that not affect the value of your vehicle? It absolutely does.
Straight ahead, Maria Chaleos up next with Utah's new news. It's the start of Avalanche Awareness Week.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas,
in the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now, too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.